2 weeks ago, I talked about God the Creator. Last week, y'all had two good preachers. Charles Williams spoke on Sunday morning, and Matt Miller spoke on Sunday evening. I think I made a few copies of the CD, if y'all want a copy of that. If you didn't, if they're gone, well, let me know, and I'll make some more. I made a special bulletin for this week, and I printed some extra ones for you to use in inviting people to our special weekend and beginning meeting, starting on Thursday night and ending on Sunday night or Sunday afternoon. And so take as many of those as you want, and if they run out, I'll make some more. So as I said, 2 weeks ago, we talked about God the Creator. Today we're going to talk about God, the God of Providence. Providence is defined by W.E. Vine as forethought. Compound word pro, meaning before, and noeo, meaning to think. To think before is the idea of providence. Translated providence in Acts chapter 24 and verse 2, the King James uses the word providence. The New King James uses the word foresight. And it's also translated, same word is translated in both versions in Romans chapter 13 and verse 14 as provision. Interestingly, the Bible never talks about the providence of God specifically. And yet the Bible clearly teaches the providence of God. In both of the passages where the word providence, and the Greek at least, is used, is talking about human beings and their providential and their forethought. But certainly the Bible teaches clearly that God has a forethought. God has providence. And God works in providence. In the creation, of course, which we discussed 2 weeks ago, His work is finished. In chapter 2 of Genesis and in verses 2 and 3, we read there that after the 6 days of creation, this is what it says. And on the seventh day, God ended His work, which He had done. And He rested on the seventh day from all His work which He had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it because He had rested from all His work which God had created and made. And so the work of creation was finished after 6 days. In the fourth chapter of Hebrews and in verse 4, the writer of Hebrews said, "For He has spoken in a certain place of the seventh day in this way, and God rested on the seventh day from all His works." And in verse 10 of the same chapter, he says, "For he who has entered into his rest has himself also ceased from his works, as God did from his." And so when we finish our course here, we will cease from our work as God ceased from his work. So God ceased in his work so far as creative work is concerned. But he didn't stop working. And that's where providence comes in. In John chapter 5 and in verse 17, Jesus, in speaking about His own work and the work His Father, had this to say. John chapter 5 and verse 17. "But Jesus answered them, 'My Father has been working until now, and I have been working.'" And so Jesus clearly said that His Father was still working. And so how was He working? The work of creation was finished. But he says God is still working. And so we need to understand that God is still at work. Now atheism says, and deists as well, say that, of course atheists say there is no God. Deists say there's a God, but he did the creation and he has nothing to do with it ever since. Humanists, which is just another name for atheists, made a manifesto. In fact, there's been two of them. They had one and then they revised it later and added some other things to it. But the Humanist Manifesto says, "We discover no divine purpose or providence for the human species. While there is much that we do not know, humans are responsible for what we are or will become. No deity will save us. We must save ourselves." And so that's the atheistic attitude, that there is no God, and if we're going to be saved, we'll have to save ourselves. Because there is no God to save us. Therefore, God didn't create according to them and doesn't providentially work, certainly, according to them. I want to talk first about a general sense in which God works in providence. And this is in the sense that He upholds everything. In fact, in Colossians chapter 1 and in verse 17, in talking here about the work of Jesus and what He has done as God created all things through Jesus, in verse 17 of the first chapter says, "And He is before all things," talking about Christ, "and in Him all things consist," or "they are held together." The writer of Hebrews said basically the same thing in Hebrews 1 and verse 3, "Who being the brightness of His glory and the express image of His person, and upholding all things by the word of His power, when He had by Himself purged our sins, sat down at the right hand of majesty on high." And so here the work of Jesus, what is it? All things are upheld. All things consist. All things are held together by God or by Jesus Christ. We speak sometimes of the laws of nature. And when we speak of the laws of nature, certainly there is law in nature. That is God's law that He put in nature. God governs by laws that He ordained. But He may intervene or overrule in those if he desires. And so that's the burden of our lesson this morning. God set in motion the laws of nature in nature, and they function normally. But may God intervene in the laws of nature without doing a miracle? The answer to that is yes. How does He do it? Through providence. I heard one preacher say that the way it is God has one foot on the brake and the other pedal on the accelerator, and He can speed it up or slow it down. And God can do that providentially. And that's the burden of our lesson this morning, to show that God still works in providence. We do not expect God to work miracles, but God has promised to work in providences. He may do so, as I said, miraculously or providentially, but today He works through providence. And let's notice some examples of both in our study this morning. In the first place, God provided manna for the Israelites for 40 years. In Exodus chapter 16 and in verse 4, we have the account of the giving of the manna. And I want to just notice some of the things that He said concerning that. Beginning in verse 4 of the 16th chapter, the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a quota every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in My law or not." I believe that's what Jesus meant when He said, "It's written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God." God gave the manna, but He also gave instructions. And of course, there were some of the Jews who didn't listen to what He said. He said there would be manna for 6 days, but on the Friday there wouldn't be any. Because on the Sabbath day, they were not to go out and do any work. And this is the first time we have any law about the Sabbath, is just before they get to Mount Sinai, really, where He gives, I believe, a preparatory to what He's going to give as a law on Mount Sinai, that you can't do any work, and if you did, you would be killed. But anyway, they were to gather enough for one day, except on Friday. And on Friday, they could gather enough for 2 days. I want to read some of these verses, not all of these verses, verses 14 to 24. And it says, "When the layer of dew lifted, there on the surface of the wilderness was a small round substance as fine as frost on the ground. So the children of Israel saw it, and they said to one another, 'Manna!'" Translated, "What is it?" That's what manna means. "Manna! What is it?" And they just called it, "What is it?" "For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, 'This is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat.'" And he goes on to give instructions. In verse 20, he says, "Notwithstanding, they did not heed Moses, for some of them left part of it until the morning. It bred worms and stank. And Moses was angry with them. So he said, 'You eat it every day. And if any was left over, it bred worms and it stank overnight. But on Friday, they could gather enough for 2 days.' And it did not breed worms nor stink. Now, folks, that's miraculous. Bread doesn't breed worms and stink from Thursday to Friday, but not do it on Friday to Saturday. I mean, that's not nature's rule. That was a miracle. God did this for 40 years. He fed those people for 40 years. And at Joshua chapter 5, we have when it ended. Joshua chapter 5, I want to turn over and read that, where Joshua mentions in verse 12 of God's care for them during this period of time. It says, "Now the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten the produce of the land," that's in Canaan, "and the children of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate food of the land of Canaan that year." For 40 years, God gave them plenty to eat on Monday to Friday, and on Friday gave them enough to eat for 2 days. That's miraculous. And so God worked miraculously in His creation. That was typical, by the way, of another miracle, how God feeds us. In John chapter 6, we read about the bread from heaven. And, of course, you're familiar with that. Jesus said, "I am the bread." I want to read a few of these verses. In verses 30 through 35 of John 6, where Jesus said, we'll start in verse 30. "Therefore they said to Him, 'What sign will you perform that we may know or see and believe you? What work will you do? Our fathers ate the manna in the desert. As it is written, He gave them bread from heaven to eat.' Jesus said to them, 'Most assuredly, I say to you, Moses did not give you the bread from heaven, but My Father gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is He who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world.'" Skip down to verses 49 and 50, where Jesus said, "I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness and are dead." Well, what's Jesus talking about? Jesus is saying, "I am the true bread. I am the bread for spiritual life. The Jews ate the physical manna and they are dead. But if you eat of Me, you won't die." Now, sometimes this passage is read and at the Lord's table as though it's talking about the Lord's Supper. In verse 58, He says, "This is the bread which came down from heaven, not as your fathers ate the manna and are dead. He who eats this bread will live forever." That's not talking about the Lord's Supper. That's talking about Jesus. In the 8th chapter in verse 52, there's a parallel statement to it. In chapter 8 and verse 52, "Then the Jews said to Jesus, 'Now we know that you have a demon. Abraham is dead, and the prophets, and you say, if anyone keeps My word, he will never taste death. If anyone keeps My word, he will not taste of death.' But in chapter 6 He says, 'If he that eats this bread will live forever.'" In other words, if you eat this bread, you'll live forever. You won't die. "Or he who keeps My word will not die." And so what's Jesus talking about? He's not talking about the Lord's Supper. He's talking about keeping His word. Eating His bread and keeping His word are the same thing. And so it was typical, the manna in the wilderness was typical, as far as it could typify it, of Jesus Christ, who is the true bread of life. Now, another case of a miracle in the Old Testament, 1 Kings chapter 18. And it's one of my favorite stories, of course, Elijah and his confrontation with the 450 prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel. When Joyce and I had the privilege of going to the Bible lands, we went up there, and there's a monument to Elijah on top of that mountain, Mount Carmel. And the only thing else that's up there is a gift store. And that's all that's up there. And Alan nods yes. He was up there too. But anyway, the fire that was given was miraculous. Elijah prayed for fire, and verse 38 says, "Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt sacrifice and the wood and the stones and the dust, and it licked up the water that was in the trench." Now that was a miracle. The prophets of Baal tried to do it previously. Remember, he said to Elijah said, "You provide the two animals and you go ahead and offer your sacrifice first, and then I'll offer mine after you've done it. They made their altar. And it's interesting to me that in chapter 18, I underlined some of the words that these false prophets, these prophets of Baal, use. Verse 26 says, they called on the name of Baal from morning until evening. End of that verse says, they leaped about the altar. They were leaping around it, jumping around it on the altar. Verse 28 says, they cut themselves with knives and lances or spears. And verse 29 says, no voice, no answer, no attention. Baal didn't hear, he didn't answer, he didn't pay attention. Why? Because he's not a god. He's not God. And so, remember that Elijah made fun of him. Said, cry a little louder, maybe he's asleep. Or maybe he's been called out on a trip. And call a little louder. One of the expressions means really, maybe he's out at the restroom. Cry a little louder. Just ridiculing them. And when they had not gotten any answer, finally then Elijah had four water pots filled with water three times. 12 water pots of water poured over the sacrifice. And he asked God to send fire from heaven, and you know what happened. And fire came, and it devoured the altar, devoured the sacrifice, devoured the water in the trenches around it. Now, that's a miracle. Now, we don't expect God to do things like that today. But that was miraculous. And as I said, we cannot expect God to do those things today. Now, let's look at some miracles and providence similar. The birth of Jesus is a miracle. In Matthew 1, verse 23, behold, a virgin shall be with child and bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which is translated God with us. Folks, we know that virgins don't have children. Now, that's not natural. Virgins do not have children. And yet, here was Mary, who was a virgin, and she had a child. Now, in the Old Testament, we have a record of the birth of Samuel, who was born as a providential act of God. In 1 Samuel, in chapter 1, and verses 10 through verse 20, we have the idea here of Hannah was praying, and Eli thought she was drunk. And he said something to her about being drunk and getting off of that wine. And she pled with him, no, I'm not drunk. I am in grief because I want a child. And she said that if she could have a child, she would dedicate him to the service of God. And of course, Eli told her to go home, and you're going to have a child, a son. It came to pass, verse 19, then they arose early in the morning and worshiped before the Lord and returned to their house at Ramah. That's Elkanah and Hannah. Elkanah knew his wife, and the Lord remembered her. So it came to pass in the process of time that Hannah conceived and bore a son and called his name Samuel, saying, because I have asked for him from the Lord. Folks, this is a providential answer to prayer by God. He didn't do it miraculously. He did it the same way that Adam and Eve had Cain. It said Adam knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and had Cain. That's what knowing your wife means. And so that's the way Adam and Eve reproduced. That's the way that Hannah received her son. And so, was it an answer to prayer? Yes, it was, because the Bible tells us it was. And yet, it was not a miracle. God answered it providentially. Now, we have the same thing when it comes to miraculous and providential and healings. In John, the 9th chapter, verses 1-7, we have the account of the man who was born blind. And Jesus made some spittle on the ground and put the clay on the blind man's eyes and told him to go wash and he would come back seeing. And he did. Now that's a miracle. Pharisees didn't like it, of course, because they didn't believe that Jesus was the Son of God. And they tried every way they could. to undermine the work of Jesus, but the fact is that it was a miracle, and the man who had been born blind could see. In the third chapter of Acts, we have the account of the Apostle Peter as he was at the temple, and he saw this man who was lame, and he was begging at the temple gate. And this is the account in the third chapter of Acts, beginning in verse 1. Now, Peter and John went up together to the temple at the hour of prayer, at the ninth hour. And a certain lame man from his mother's womb was carried, whom they laid daily at the gate of the temple, which is called Beautiful, to ask alms from those who entered the temple. So again, here was a man who was lame from birth and evidently had never walked. I told some of you about seeing a man. This is common in Romania. You see people who have defects out on the street sitting in a wheelchair or sitting on the ground and begging for money. There's this one boy I'd seen several times in a wheelchair sitting out on the street and they're holding out their hand for money, and people will give them money. One day, I happened to be walking along and a puff of wind came along, and it blew his money, blew it out of his hand, and he jumped out of that wheelchair and run, gathered that up, and jumped back in the wheelchair. Now, there's no miracle about that, folks. This man was lame. He could not walk. And he wasn't pretending. And so he asked Peter for alms, and fixing his eyes on him, said to John, Peter said, "Look at us." So he gave them his attention, expecting to receive something from them. Peter said, "Silver and gold I do not have, but what I do have I give you. In the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, rise up and walk." And he took him by the right hand and lifted him up. And immediately his feet and his ankle bones received strength. So he, leaping up, stood and walked and entered the temple with them, walking and leaping and praising God. That's a miracle. And so here is a physical healing that came about instantly. It was a miracle of this case. But look at 3 John verse 2. And look what John says concerning Gaius. Gaius, of course, was a man who was beloved of John. And in verse 2 of 3 John, it says, "Beloved, I pray that you may prosper in all things and be in health, just as your soul prospers." Well, now, how's God going to answer that? How is God going to cause Gaius to prosper and be in health? Do you think he's going to send money from heaven like he sent manna to Israel? I don't think so. No indication that he was going to prosper by miraculously receiving money, nor by miraculously having health. Both of these are together. God is going to answer the prosperity and the health in the same way. How is it? Through His providence. Explain it? I don't know how. It means God's forethought, where God can work things for the benefit of those who need it. Thus, He can answer prayers in that way. Look at some examples in the Old Testament of God's providence. In the case when God told Abraham to offer his son Isaac as a sacrifice, and he was willing to do it, he raised his hand and started to take his life, and God stopped him. An angel of God, which I believe, by the way, I'm going to preach on that sometime, and I'll work up a lesson on it. The angel of God, I believe, refers to Jesus Christ. And I'll try to prove that in a lesson later. But if you follow here in chapter 22, you can see that when it says the angel in verse 11, the angel of the Lord called to him, "Abraham, Abraham," and he said, "Here am I." And then he says, "Do not lay your hand upon the lad or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." Who is that? The angel, God, me. And so then this is when Abraham had said to Isaac, "God will provide And then in verses 13, continuing, Abraham lifted his eyes and looked, and there behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. So Abraham went and took the ram and offered it for a burnt offering instead of his son. And Abraham called the name of the place, "The Lord will provide. As it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord it shall be provided." Now when it says God is going to provide, how did He provide? He didn't create a ram to drop down in front of Abraham, did He? There was a ram there, caught his horns in the bush, and Abraham went and got the lamb and offered his sacrifice. Who provided it? God did. That's what it means. God will provide. God provided it. But He didn't do it miraculously. He did it through an act of His providence. In the book of Genesis, chapter 45, we have Joseph, who'd been deceived, or had been, his brothers had deceived his father into thinking that he was dead. They'd sold him down in Egypt, and you're familiar with that story. He stayed down there for years, became one of the rulers in Egypt, and then the brothers had to come down to Egypt to buy grain, and when he finally revealed himself to them, I want to read verses 5 through 8 of the 45th chapter. "But now, do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves," Moses said, "because you sold me here. For God sent me before you." How did God send him? He sent him through some jealous brothers who went down. He didn't just drop him down in Egypt. He said, "God sent me before you. For these 2 years, the famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me before you." Who did? God sent me to preserve the posterity for you in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now it was not you who sent me here, but God. And He has made me father to Pharaoh and Lord of all his house and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt. So Joseph said, and Moses recorded, that God sent him to Egypt. Not a miraculous way, but in a providential way. In God's providence, God had Joseph where He needed him at the right time. Do you think God still is the same God of providence? I believe He is. I think we need to be careful about ascribing things. We'll say more about that in a little bit. But anyway, we need to be careful about saying God sent me to this or God sent me there. But I believe in the providence of God today. Same God that sent Joseph. Deuteronomy chapter 11. In providing the material necessities of the needs of the people. Deuteronomy chapter 11. And in verses 13 through 17. Deuteronomy 11 beginning in verse 13 says, "And it shall be, if you diligently obey my commandments, which I command you today, to love the Lord and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul, then I will give you the rain for your land in its season, the early rain and the latter rain, that you may gather in your grain, your wine, and your oil. And I will send grass in your fields for your livestock, that you may eat it and be filled. Take heed to yourselves, lest your heart be deceived and you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them, lest the Lord's anger be aroused against you and He shut up the heavens so that there be no rain and the land yield no produce and you perish quickly from off the good land which the Lord is giving you." How did God give them grass? Through providence. He didn't just drop down grass out in their field. He sent the rain. The seed produced, and God provided the grass. And so that's what it said. Physical blessings were provided. Now, look at some providential statements in the New Testament. Jesus taught us, "Ask and you shall receive, seek and you shall find, knock, and it shall be opened to you." Now, how are we going to do that? Whatever God tells us to ask for, or to seek or to knock in order to enter, He must not exclude Himself from some way providing what we ask for. He wouldn't tell us to ask for something if He were not going to hear and answer it in some way. Now, sometimes the answer is no, but He answers. What I'm saying is, He wouldn't teach us to do something that He had no intention of responding to. And so when He said ask, seek, and knock, it means that He will listen. Notice some examples in Colossians chapter 4, verses 2 through 4, where Paul asked the Colossians, pray the Lord that He will open doors of opportunity. That He will open doors that He may be able to teach the Word of God. Well, does that mean that literally that God was going to open the, miraculously give Paul an opportunity to preach? I don't think so. But he said to the Colossians, you pray that God would open the door. 1 Timothy chapter 2, or 2 in verses 1 and 2. Paul said that we're to pray for our rulers, or for our kings, and those in authority. Why? In order that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life. Miraculously? Probably not. But we're to pray for our rulers. If we're to pray for our rulers, what does that indicate? That God will hear. Didn't say He'd always give it, but God will hear. And the rulers that they were praying for in that day weren't very good, were they? But anyway, we're to pray for our rulers that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life. We're to pray about our personal plans. James chapter 4. James talks about some who were just so sure of what they were going to do. And he reminds them, come now. We'd say, wait a minute. You who say, today or tomorrow, we will go to such and such a place, spend a year there, buy and sell and get a profit or make a profit. Whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then it vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall both live and do this or that. But now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. And so what are we to do? We're to pray about our jobs, about a personal plan. Somebody says, I'm going to go to such and such, and I'm going to go to Australia or wherever. Joyce's brother and I used to be talking about that. We're going to go to Australia. That was both his idea. I would have never thought about it. I'm going to go to Australia, and we're going to go over there and get a job, work 5 years, and come back to the United States and retire for life. You know, I mean, we're going to do this. We're going to do that. What does James say? Wait a minute. You better say if it's the Lord's will, we'll live and do this or that. Well, how do you know it's the Lord's will? You're going to pray about it. You're going to pray. We are also to pray for wisdom. James chapter 1, verses 5 and 6. James 1, verse 5 and 6. If any lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all liberally and without reproach, and it will be given him. And so, what are we to pray for? We're to pray for wisdom. But let him ask in faith, not doubting, for he who doubts is like a wave of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. So who is he talking to here? The Mormons use this and tell you if you will pray for God to tell you whether the Book of Mormon is from God or not, he will tell you that it is. This is the passage they abuse to teach this. Notice to whom this is written. James, a servant of God, to the 12 tribes who are scattered abroad. This is God's people who are scattered abroad. Verse 2, my brethren, count it all joy. Let it be the patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect, complete, lacking nothing. If any of you lacks wisdom, you who? You disciples, you Christians. This isn't talking about somebody praying for God to lead them in some miraculous way or even a providential way to see that the Bible is true. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about praying for wisdom to apply what God has revealed. If you lack wisdom, ask of God. And so this is what James is talking about here. And again, not in a miraculous way, but in a providential way. We need to remember always, 1 John 5, verse 14, he gives it to us if we ask according to his will. And so just because we ask doesn't mean He's going to give it to us. It may not be according to His will. We need to be careful about blaming God for consequences of selfish decisions. He doesn't lead us to violate His will. He never does that. Brother Robert Turner, several years ago, told a story about he was talking to this woman about she wanted to marry a certain man, and either she had been divorced and didn't divorce her husband for fornication, or else the man that she was going to marry had been divorced. I don't remember the details of it, but one or the other of them didn't have the scriptural grounds to marry. And this woman says, well, I have prayed to the Lord about it, and the Lord has led me to believe that it's all right. And so I prayed to God about it, and I just feel that the Lord is leading me to do this. Brother Turner said, well, would you mind if I ask Him? She said, no, that'd be fine. So he opened his Bible to Matthew 19 and read, I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery, and whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. He said, he told me it wouldn't be a good idea. Now, what's our attitude? Are we going to decide, well, now, this is what I just feel that the Lord wants me to do it. One young man told me he was dating this girl, and I didn't think it was a very good match, and it didn't matter to me, it didn't matter to him what I thought. But he said, we're just seeing where the Lord leads us. I said, yeah, what you going to do? You're going to get yourself in a big mess, and then you're going to blame it on God. That's what you're going to do. And that's what people do sometimes. They get themselves in a mess, and then they blame God for the mess they're in. God never leads us into something that's wrong. And anyone who's convinced himself that he can do wrong because he feels that God is leading him in that way is being led by something other, someone other than God. And so God never does that. We may not know how He will give when we ask, how we will find if we seek, nor when the door will be opened if we knock. But if we seek, ask, and seek and knock, then we're doing what God has told us to do. And then whose responsibility is it? It's God's responsibility to provide. We have the responsibility to ask and seek and knock. God's responsibility is to answer, to open, and to provide providentially the things that He has promised to do. So the God of creation is the God of providence. His work of creation is finished, but His work of providence, He still works. And if He didn't, there'd be no point in praying. There'd be no point in worshiping as far as that's concerned. If He didn't continue to approve or disapprove what we do. And so we need to understand that He works providentially as we conform to His Word and live according to that. If you need to obey the gospel this morning, we're going to sing this song as an opportunity for you to confess your faith in Jesus and be baptized into Him. Or if you need to be restored to the Lord, we invite you to let that be known while we stand together and while we sing.